On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, the Red Sox fire Alex Cora in April and a whole bunch of his coaches as well. We react to the huge news for the Boston Red Sox over the weekend. Four sweeps and a whole lot of quality baseball. Let's get to it. It's Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world ready to podcast the way that Alex Cora would want us to podcast. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. We're going to do it for him.
We will honor his managerial memory on this Monday edition of Baseball Barbacast. And yeah, surprise, surprise, Alex Cora got fired, and that's our opener.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. A shocker. A stunner, a blind sider. Alex Cora out is the manager of the Boston Red Sox. Cora first hired for this role in the autumn of 2017, leads the Red Sox to a World Series title in his first season as the skipper. Only the fifth manager in MLB history to win a World Series as a rookie manager. That sets the tone for the tenure as he maintains that position all the way up until Saturday evening, when he was, I would say, very ceremoniously let go as manager by a triad of Boston higher-ups. That is owner John Henry, team president Sam Kennedy, chief baseball officer Craig Breslow. And this was genuinely shocking. I was in Boston on Friday for that game. I was in Boston yesterday on Sunday for all of the fallout and aftermath, and this was as someone who follows the sport for a living, a phenomenally drama-filled weekend.
We will, of course, get into your firsthand account of this situation, doing some reporting over the weekend. As we try and wrap our minds around the timing, I think that we can reflect on his whole tenure, but I also think just even more recently, you know, on Friday morning, we, for good, bad, ugly, for bad, we did the Boston Red Sox because they were just swept at home by the New York Yankees. And we've kind of bounced around all these teams that are having catastrophic starts to the season, whether it is the Red Sox. Of course, the Red Sox were kind of first up because they had like the worst record first. They were 2-7 or whatever it was. So we're focused on them. And since we've, of course, shifted to the Mets and the Phillies, and we'll cover them later on in this episode. But we didn't really have an Alex Cora, is Alex Cora safe conversation, certainly not on Friday, and really not at any point in the recent weeks. And a lot of that is because of what you wrote about as your first reaction to this, and I think something that a lot of people have pointed out with him when thinking about this, is his position, his security, his role in this organization has only been reinforced over time. Even as the Red Sox have had disappointing seasons, it has not been smooth sailing since he won the World Series in his first year. And we should mention, he also took a little year off there because he was suspended for the sign-stealing scandal.
Oops.
The 2020 Red Sox, now it worked out well because it was 2020, a season that then allowed them to tank, get Marcelo Meyer, and also just bring Alex Cora back like nothing happened. So the timing of all that was very strange. But that was another example, in addition to his staying on as Dombrowski is gone and Bloom is gone. And then even last year or 2 years ago, him getting an extension, even with the new front office. Alex Cora, time and again, was demonstrate the organization, and through how they acted, actions over words in a lot of cases, Alex Cora had juice, as you would say, right? This guy was important in a way that not all managers are. And you could argue almost no other manager in the sport was, yeah, at least in recent memory. He's not the only one. But that is part of why this becomes a stunning thing once you remove the fact that the Red Sox have been playing terrible baseball this season.
Sure. But it's not just that he was surviving, it's that he was more involved and engaged in baseball decisions than your average manager. I'm talking trades, I'm talking free agent signings. A lot of managers nowadays are simply implementing the preferences and directives of the president of baseball operations or the general manager, or in this one very bizarre case, the chief baseball officer. But Cora was not that. Cora had sway moving up as well as sway moving down. And though he is not necessarily the most beloved person in every single corner of the baseball industry, players like him. Players really like him. He had a lot of sway within that clubhouse. And I think that he is generally considered to be good at this very nebulous job. We don't necessarily know what makes someone good or bad at it, besides knowing the rules and not being a total schmuck. But Cora has a reputation for being a quality manager. And yet, despite all of that, the Red Sox brass saw it fit to lay this man off and kick him to the curb. So what I'd like to do now is run through the sequence of events over the last 72 to 150 hours, basically. It all begins, really, middle of last week when the Red Sox are swept at home by the Yankees. Which, you know, that's a big deal when you're the Red Sox manager, getting swept at home by the Yankees. There's a lot of chatter about the Red Sox vibes and how they look sleepy and how they look punchless. They roll up to Camden Yards for a three-game weekend set. Alex Cora is 45 minutes late to his media availability. That makes some people, including me, around the situation think that something is up. He says that he was just talking to his kids. I understand and appreciate that. I would love to have been talking to my family members for 45 minutes while Alex Cora made everybody wait. But I wasn't. Cora then does the pregame, manages a baseball game in which the Red Sox get clobbered. There's three first inning home runs. Brian Bello is bad. Wakes up Saturday morning. Manages another game. The Red Sox win 17-1. Everything is hunky-dory. They head back to the Four Seasons Hotel in Baltimore. And the angels of death are waiting for him at the hotel. That is Craig Breslow, Sam Kennedy, John Henry, the same trio that went out to talk to Rafi Devers last summer before he was traded. They were not on this trip. None of Breslow, Kennedy, and Henry were on this trip. And so the fact that they even flew in surely must have, the second that Alex Cora saw them there or heard they were there, he would have known. Do I think he knew before this point? I do not, based upon what I thought. I think that like he was just more frustrated with how things were going than like hyper aware that he was about to get axed. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's the thing. If you want to speculate, it doesn't excuse being 45 minutes late to your media thing. But maybe he could have gotten word because they didn't show up until Saturday. They weren't even there on Friday after that
correct.
Loss.
They came in Saturday morning.
Right. And so, and Saturday is, you know, they win by a lot of runs. And so you think, oh, and Cora does his post-game.
Can you just pause here?
Hey, we want to.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
So that game starts at noon. It's moved up from 4 o'clock because there's a rain delay, or there's rain in the forecast. Breslow, Kennedy, and Henry are probably like in a hotel suite with the game on, knowing that they're about to fire Cora in a couple of hours, and the Red Sox can't stop scoring. That must have been a fascinating experience.
What was it, 10 runs in the top of the ninth? I know.
Like, how many runs would the Red Sox
Weston
have had
Wilson.
To score? Like, if the Red Sox break the all-time record for runs in a game, they score, like, you know, 55 runs against the Orioles.
Yeah.
And then they fire him
they
anyway.
Needed, oh! They needed to score more before Weston Wilson was pitching to maybe have made difference. But the timing there, it does seem the result of that game was not going to matter at some point between, it seems, Thursday and Saturday morning. The decision was made And here we go. So then we get a really, I know now you were not there on Saturday, so that's important to note.
No.
However, Chris Cotillo sure was. Not
Let's
just
clap
at the
it up.
Baseball game.
Clap it up. Not Chris Cotillo of Mass game. Live. Chris Cotillo, mm-hmm. beat writer for the Red Sox at Mass Live, rising to the moment. All time performances in ball writer history. This was Cotillo's, like the you know, the meme of like the Wilt Chamberlain stat line. Like this was Cotillo mm-hmm. this weekend. The man cooked. The man couldn't miss. He goes to the hotel to survey the scene. And what does he see? Oh, he sees a whole lot. A lot of which he wrote over at Mass Live. I recommend going and reading it. The important things that he sees there are Cora and the fired coaches. We should probably mention there are five other members of the coaching staff that were laid off. That is, I'm not going to go through all the names, but the big ones are hitting coach Peter Fatsy and then game planning coach Jason Veritek, who is also, you know, something of a franchise legend. He's technically reassigned within the organization, which is just code for this guy's too important to lay him off. Veritek may or may not roll with that. He may or may not tell the organization to pound sand, whatever. Cotillo sees like the goodbyes between those folks and the other coaches and the players. Like the players are walking back from being out to dinner. Some of them are home. I believe Garrett Whitlock told us that he was lying in bed and he got a FaceTime from Trevor Story, and that's how he found out. Like the players were kind of finding out through word of mouth, like the rest of us. There was no edict from on high, no email from the higher ups to the players or something, right? And then the comedic cherry on top of this dysfunctional Sunday, coaches for hire. For those of you who have not seen this, this is an all freaking timer. So like an airport van pulls up to the hotel to take the Red Sox coaches to Baltimore Washington International Airport to fly them back to Boston. And the van that comes to get them, on the side of the van, it says coaches for, the letter for, coaches for hire, LLC. Coaches for hire, LLC. Unfathomable. Like, there are moments in this life, in this baseball life, where I believe more in there being a higher power. We often talk about like the D. Gordon home run, right? Where it's like the only way this could happen is if there's someone, there's something up there. Coaches for hire goes on that list.
I have so many. Obviously, this is like Hall of Fame level UGLA that we're maybe we'll come back to it on Friday and do even more on it. But this is so funny. They are on the road, right? So whoever who works for the Red Sox who was tasked with arranging this ride for them, they of course thought they were doing them a favor, right? They were like, oh, this is great. We're going to send them on. I believe they sent them on the jet back to Boston. Like they arranged all that, giving them a very honorable send off. We should also note here, before we return to just like how important this is for baseball or for the Red Sox and Alex Cora and whatever, what we've seen and heard from Alex Cora since then, because this group of coaches led by Cora now appear to be on a tour of Boston. Cora's like posted photos from an Italian restaurant, and I'm going to go ahead and call this right now. What are the chances that this group of coaches group chat right now has since been renamed Coaches for Hire?
Coaches
LLC?
For Hire. This was already discussed yesterday at the ballpark. I made the same recommendation. It has to be Coaches for Hire. If it's not Coaches for Hire, they deserved to get fired, is kind of where I'm at. The other thing about the Coaches for Hire that's so good, dude, is like it could have been any other name. It could be a van that doesn't have the Coaches for Hire on it. Like it could have been called Coaches for Hire and not have the branding.
We never would have known.
Or
never would have known.
It could have been on the other side of the van. Like If it's on the left side of the van instead of the right side of the van, Chris Cotillo never sees this. We never see it. You know what I mean? Like, or the what, or, all the things that have to line up.
Or like, it's on the other side. It drives away. Cotillo sees it but can't get a picture. And then he's left to like tell people about it. But like, everyone's like,
and we're
really?
Like, sure,
like,
buddy.
Oh, you know, but that would have cost them so many retweets. So I'm happy for Chris that he got this. It is an all-time photo. And bringing it back to Cora, right? It seems like they seem to be taking it in stride relatively. We can speculate on how much of that is their own interpretation of what's happening. I think that there is something unique about half a staff getting fired at once, because they have this now weird new brotherhood that normally when one guy gets canned, like, this is a unique situation that in some respects I'm not surprised that this is how they are handling it. That doesn't mean that they're not pissed and upset that they're out of a job. I don't want to like shuffle that to the side, but I do think in this immediate aftermath, because of the unique circumstance, which, as we mentioned, a manager getting fired in April, that's rare, a manager and half his staff getting fired in April, I mean, now we're adding all the circumstances here are so unique. So because of that, I'm not shocked that I hope they're doing this all summer. Maybe they end up getting hired by other organizations before then. I think this should go on Kimmel. That we're just seeing. They should just go everywhere and just let it eat, man. Like, just go.
They should go throughout the first pitch at like a Red Sox game. They should go throughout the first pitch.
They should just go buy some tickets. Go buy some tickets and sit behind them. Was it funnier to sit behind the home dugout or the visitors dugout?
I think it's funniest to sit in the outfield, in the monster.
What's stopping
you? So yeah, dude. And then one last thing here. Alex Cora tweeting at 4 a.m., I'm happy, or happy, texting all the beat writers, happy, posting on Instagram an interview in which that's like, I can't believe the Red Sox traded Mookie Betts.
So hilarious. I want to talk about that.
Kind of unprofessional.
Yeah, that's totally fair. My interpretation of the Mookie clip that he posted, the clip was Mookie saying, like, it was Mookie talking about, it's a business. I love the Red Sox. Like, it is nothing about them. It's business. I'm interpreting that as him being like, I love Boston. I got no beef with Boston. Boston didn't love me enough, which is, I think, really what he's saying. He's not posing that to be like, these idiots traded Mookie Betts. I mean, maybe it's part of that. I think it's more of the sentiment of what Mookie was talking about in that clip. But either way, that doesn't excuse. I think your point is valid. That was my interpretation of that clip in particular.
Yeah, just like, don't post at 4 a.m. the night you get fired and you've maybe had, you know, a couple libations. I just don't think that's... I mean, it's hilarious, but it's also like, what are we doing? Okay, Sunday morning.
Yes.
I get in my tiny little Prius. I drive up to Camden Yards. It's Little League Day. So you show up to Camden Yards and there's 3,000 to 5,000 children in their uniforms outside the stadium when I roll up. Just one of those great moments. There was one great moment where I was in the elevator with Chris Cotillo and like a Little League team with basically there was one kid who was probably like 9 and he was the assistant coach for a team of 4-year-olds. And we were like, hey, man, you want to come manage the Red Sox? He's like, sure. That sounds great. Okay, so we show up there and the opening ceremony for this very weird day was Craig Breslow, Sam Kennedy press conference, which was conducted at 10:45 a.m. Breslow, the chief baseball officer since the end of 2023, I believe, taking over for Chaim Bloom. Sam Kennedy has been there forever. Sam Kennedy is effectively the mouthpiece for owner John Henry, who does not talk to the media. More on that later. Breslow and Kennedy, in kind of odd fashion, breaking from traditional protocol, using the Orioles interview room and conducting this entire session with the Orioles backdrop behind them. Very much an odd look, an image that I will remember for a long time. These guys talk for about 25 minutes and offer very few revealing answers.
Yeah. Which wasn't particularly shocking for me, but Let's so then fine. If they're not going to give us the answers, let's talk about what we can interpret from why this happened.
Yeah, let's interpret. Well, let's just, I mean, Breslow and Kennedy are effectively asked by Sean McAdam, why did you do this? He didn't say it exactly that way, but he was like, why now? Why did you feel like this was necessary? And Breslow rips off an all-time Breslow quote. Breslow, who has been criticized for being robotic and lacking feel over the years, he played in the big leagues and acts like he only played at McKinsey sometimes, says, quote, I don't think it's productive to get into the merits of an individual decision. I mean, sure.
Why are you sitting up there? Why even bother having the press conference then? Why even bother show up? Like, just,
we would
just
like to get into the merits of this individual decision. You decisioning to no longer employ Alex Cora feels like the merits of which should be investigated. That would be a productive use of my time. So yeah, I will always remember, I don't think it's productive to get into the merits of an individual decision. Beep boop.
The other thing, so then it's like, okay, well, I guess you don't want to divulge why you did this. Then maybe the other important question is, who decided to do this? So what do we get from those questions?
Those questions, that question asked by yours truly, Jacob Mintz, I was like, hey, because it was alluded to a little bit earlier in the presser, but it wasn't like clear. So I said, hey, Sam Kennedy, just to be clear, is it fair to characterize this decision as Craig Breslow's decision? He said, absolutely. I think the full quote is like, Craig leads our baseball operation. He's made several bold decisions and recommendations. This is one of them. We fully support it. So this is interesting because Sam Kennedy is putting this decision on Craig Breslow's shoulders, which means that if it goes sideways, Craig Breslow will be there to eat it as well in the future, throwing maybe another Red Sox individual under the bus.
Which we zoom all the way out, and I think this is kind of the sentiment that Ken Rosenthal wrote about. How many can we just like take it easy here? Like, how many times are we to keep pointing the fingers and be like, nope, now it's that guy's fault? John Henry and Sam Kennedy have been above it the whole time, or at least for much of this. But the amount of turnover here, now not just, this is what's so wild about this, right? Think about how much turnover we've had at the front office level, and now more recently, the roster. Alex Cora has survived a lot of this, so the managers and the coaches, there has been consistency there.
Yep.
And now we're blowing that part up too, which it just becomes this very chaotic and exhausting experience for Red Sox fans in particular, who certainly have their lofty standards, as they should. It's just kind of dizzying to deal with.
And it is dizzying, and it is reminiscent, Jordan, of the way that English soccer teams are run. And I think that that is maybe a data point here worth pointing out, that John Henry, who owns Liverpool as well, one of the biggest soccer teams in the UK, like, the constant turnover in that league is more than dizzying, right? And so I think that we have now learned that this organization, this ownership group, has a willingness to turn over its personnel at a higher rate than really any other, you know. And let's talk about Henry now here. Cowardice. John Henry was on the premises. John Henry was in the meeting between Craig Breslow, new manager Chad Tracy, whose name we literally have not said yet. Breslow and Tracy addressed the team before the game on Sunday. Kennedy and Henry are in the room. Neither of them say a word to the baseball team. They're just like lurking in the shadow, like in the room. Kennedy at least addresses the media. Henry does not. He's there. People see him in the elevator. They see him leaving. Like, the lack of willingness to, you know, grapple with the consequences of his actions or inactions is startling and very different than I think the way a lot of other owners would handle this. And I am very sympathetic to Red Sox fans It is incredibly frustrating. It is part of the larger like private equityization of baseball and sports. But the lack of personalness that he is conveying, he is not acting like this is a stewardship. And in my mind, John Henry clearly sees the Red Sox as this vital American institution. And the way that he has conducted himself is unbecoming of that, of what he sees the operation as. And so in my opinion, like, he should be embarrassed today if he's not. I'm sure he's not, but he should be.
Yeah, I think my difficulty talking about Henry is the context of all of these front offices and leadership groups. Sometimes we like when the rich guy gives them all the money to work with and then shuts up and stays out of the way. Sometimes that's great. And that has worked very well in certain circumstances. So you could argue that if you are viewing this from John Henry's perspective, now this still completely removes the context of just what the fan experience has become for the Red Sox over the last half decade. So this is why this is not a legitimate excuse. However, he's probably thinking about it. Listen, I'm spending a bunch of money on this team. Maybe not enough by some people's standards, but I'm spending a bunch of money on this team. I'm paying Sam Kennedy and Craig Breslow a lot of money to make it function. For whatever reason, I believe in them. So this is their team. They're making it. Clearly, he's the one deciding. But I do believe Sam Kennedy when he says this is Craig Breslow's decision. For whatever reason, Craig Breslow has won this, whatever power struggle you want to say. He is the one calling the shots right now. I really do not believe that John Henry decided you have to fire Alex Cora. I don't. Because I think he is very removed, which you can rightly criticize, and the fact that he refuses to ever speak to the media. I agree that is a bad thing. But from the how did we get here? How did Alex Cora get fired? Does John Henry think he needs to speak on that decision? I kind of see it both ways. On one hand, I think he should because he is the owner of this important team, and the fact that he hasn't spoken to the public at all and all the stuff that has happened since then, I totally agree with you. That's cowardice. This specific instance, I don't think he's the one that has to explain the Alex Cora decision better. I think it's the people who probably are actually making the decision.
Which is him. Quote, during the press conference from Sam Kennedy, when asked about John Henry not being there. John Breslow and I have been together for the past 48, 72 hours and have been working on this process together. I'll leave it at that. Well, if he's been working on this process with John Henry, then John Henry should speak to it. Like, sure. Sorry. He's clearly involved in that process over the last 72 hours. Even if he's involved in the process, if he's on the plane, that's the thing to me. Either come to Boston and talk and face it, or don't come at all, right? Be a ghost up in the ivory tower. You can't do both, in my opinion.
That's fair. Yeah. No, I agree. I think the point about Henry shirking the media, that's just been true for a long time now. And I don't think this is a gigantic decision, organizational decision, that he could be up there on the podium the way that some other owners are sometimes. I wasn't particularly surprised. Yeah. Okay, well, the last element of this that we have to do now is spin this forward.
Is the players.
Because John Henry's not going to suddenly call a press conference anytime soon. We have to talk about Chad Tracy. Sure. We have to talk about the players.
Yeah. So very quickly, let's just do Chad Tracy. I was impressed by Chad Tracy yesterday. Chad Tracy, not the Chad Tracy that played in the majors for the Washington Nationals. Chad Tracy is the son of Jim Tracy, former manager of the Los Angeles Dodgers. He was the manager of the AAA team in Worcester, the Woo Sox. I think he's like in his early 40s. Very well liked. Played in the minors for a while. Was the farm director for the Angels. Has been with the Red Sox for, I think, like 4 or 5 years now. He handled everything great. It was a very bizarre experience for him. Someone clearly had been dreaming of making it to the majors as a player or a coach for a long time. And to do so under these circumstances must have been very odd. He was great. And when the Red Sox won on Sunday, he was genuinely happy. And I want to give the players a lot of credit for multiple times, a number of players saying like, they're clearly frustrated that Cora was fired, but they're saying we're not going to hold that against the new people. We are not going to blame Tracy or, you know, punish him for a decision that they did not make. And I thought that that was a very mature approach and something that was kind of helpful to have verbalized. And so Tracy, you know, moving forward, he's the interim manager. There was no clarity on, you know, whether interim means temporary or for the rest of the year. We'll see if they start playing well. It'll be his job. If they don't, it won't be. And we can reassess that at the end of the season.
Yeah, but I do think that just the way that the Red Sox reacted both before Sunday's game, after Sunday's game, there's going to be an adjustment period here in terms of their right to say, well, this obviously isn't Chad Tracy. It has nothing to do with him. There's still going to be, I think there's still a disconnect that will have to be managed, literally managed, whether it's Chad Tracy's fault or not, between the players who were leaning heavily on the coaches and Alex Cora, who were all just fired, and the presumably some of the newer people that, whether they come in this year or in the future, how does that function?
But it's really the players in Breslau is the relationship that needs to be fixed or managed or massaged. And the players said that. Trevor Story said, quote, there has to be more conversations. I wouldn't say that the explanation that Breslau gave was satisfactory. You had Garrett Crochet saying that this was going to be a grieving process. You know, you had Connolly Early saying that the Red Sox played the way that Alex Cora would have wanted them to play. Like, they're not over this, and that's understandable. This guy was a manager there for a really long time. Right. It hasn't even been 24 hours. Like, I get it. That's totally fine. But there was legitimate frustration from the clubhouse bubbling up to Breslau and beyond. And that is a problem. And they, what will happen now is everyone will talk and they will say that it is fixed. Whether or not it is actually fixed, we will only learn in time. But Breslau has some work to do here. And I am skeptical in his ability to fix the situation given his track record and his lack of communication skills that we have seen kind of moving from him to the clubhouse. Like, he's good at communicating with very rich, you know, John Henry, Sam Kennedy type people, clearly, as he won this power struggle. But like, he had a quote, I don't know if I put it on the doc here, maybe I'm paraphrasing, but I asked in the press conference, like, when you make a decision like this, do you take the opinions and perspectives of the clubhouse into account, right? Like, how do you, if the manager's job is to keep the room happy, basically, how do you do that without talking to the players? And he was like, you know, you don't really talk to the players. When I was a player, we were really never consulted. That's just not really how it works. And he gave a quote that was like, it's very difficult to read the opinions of the players. And I was like, well, pal, it's kind of the job.
Yeah. I think there are
here,
larger
let me just read the quote
about,
exactly
about that job.
Let me read the quote exactly. Quote, I think, like, you know, kind of trying to figure out exactly what player sentiment is can be very, very difficult. Okay. Like, so is hitting a fastball. Like, go do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is something that we've seen with other teams about what is a healthy version of that relationship between front office and players. Yeah. Because I think sometimes you can, kind of goes back to what I was saying before about what is the job of the owner, what is the ideal balance there between involvement and how hands-on do you want them to be. Sometimes it's great, sometimes it's like, get out of here, this isn't your job. Same kind of thing. Some front office, I mean, frankly, we've seen this with the Mariners. Like, this has been an issue with Jerry DePoto in the past, clearly. In some ways, he's rallied from some of those things and has become a little bit more connected. Yeah. But there's still some things that people, and that's another former player where you think, well, how does this guy not understand? He was in these clubhouses. And so maybe their interpretation of that has shifted for whatever reason. But I agree with you. I think Breslau has a lot of work to do. And I think that's my last point here before we take a break. The argument for doing this now in April, when you never fire anybody, is that there's a whole lot of season left. In very simple terms, they're 3 games back of a wild card spot. They don't have a good record, but there's a whole lot of baseball left to be played. And if Craig Breslau believes, I have built a team that is good enough to make the postseason, there is enough time for him and I guess whoever now is going to be in charge, Chad Tracy and others, and the players, of course, first and foremost, to prove that. So I don't know what that's going to look like. I do think that regardless of how the Red Sox are playing, although certainly if they continue to struggle, I think it's more likely, we are going to hear more about the Alex Cora-Craig Breslow relationship than we did when it was still intact. That is how these things work. At some point, Alex Cora is going to call up whatever favorite reporter that he has and or just go on a podcast and just talk. I mean, I have no idea what his plans are in the immediate future, but we are going to hear more about why this broke down. And when we get those details, that is another thing that Craig Breslow is going to have to answer to respond to manage both his reputation internally and externally in this job. And that is what I think we can't totally talk about right now, even though there are people who cover the Red Sox who are much more qualified to give you those details now. And I encourage people to go, you know, enjoy that coverage and listen to those folks. That is what I'm looking forward to getting more insight on in the coming weeks, because in some senses, we are really only just getting started to understand how this actually broke apart, because they did not want to give us any sort of details yesterday. So we're going to have to wait for some reporting to get done so that we have a little bit clearer picture.
Whenever I err or fault in my home with errands or chores, my wife's like, hey, did you do the dishes? I don't think it's productive to get into the merits of an individual decision. That's what I'll say.
Let me know how that works out for you.
Get pulled over for speeding on the highway. Sir, you were going 85 on a 50. Look, officer, I don't think it's productive to get into the merits of an individual decision. Oh, okay.
Hey, give it a shot. See what happens. We're going to take a break. When we return, the Mets keep losing, folks. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. There were 14 other series over the weekend. Let's start with the sweeps.
Clean up, everybody.
There is no shame in getting swept.
I never got swept.
You guys got swept.
The Colorado Rockies taking all three games over the New York Mets in Queens. There was a rainout on Saturday, but the Rockies won both ends of the rescheduled doubleheader. On Sunday, that first game was weird. Rockies took that 4-3. Peralta, Freddie, Lorenz, and Michael both solid. The Mets just don't score enough runs. If that's a theme you enjoy, I have good news for you. They score once in the first game on Sunday. Zero times in the second game on Sunday. Senga Odelats, 2 2/3. Chase Dollander shoves it down the Mets' throat. And they are swept by the Rockies for the first time since 2018. They are 9-19. One of their worst starts in franchise history, a franchise history that has a lot of low lows. Like the 1962 Mets were a real catastrophe. The Mets DFA'd Tommy Pham and signed Austin Slater in the wake of this. We now have a lot of questions, a lot of murmuring about the job safety of manager Carlos Mendoza. Nationals heading to Queens this week for a three-game set. Jordan, what make you of all of this dysfunction?
Well, I think the first thing to say is the Mets did not just get swept by the 2025 Rockies. Okay?
Yes.
I know, like, this is a disaster. This is not to lessen anything, but before we talk about how bad the Mets are, this Rockies team is a normal bad team. And that is a huge step forward after last season. They have some really interesting pitchers, both ones that are veterans who can just kind of make you scratch your head for five innings, like Lorenzen, like Jose Quintana, and then Chase Dolander,
like Sugano,
Sugano, sure. And then Dolander's just nasty. I mean, the guy, he was a top pick for a reason. And when he was drafted by the Rockies, it was like, oh man, we're never really going to see it because he's with the Rockies and they're hopeless and their development is hopeless and he's going to have to pitch in Coors. And early in his career, that's how it was trending. Now he's starting to figure it out. He's thrown well at home. Last year, his home road splits were insane. But this year, pretty much wherever he's pitched since his first outing, he has been tremendous. You combine an arm like that with what this Mets offense currently looks like. Now, of course, without Francisco Lindor, as him and Juan Soto overlapped for what, two innings or whatever it was after Soto came back, then yeah, you're gonna get shut out. That's what's gonna happen. And the Rockies have enough competent hitters too that just like, yeah, they can go in and it is baseball. And while last year in recent years with the White Sox and Rockies, you have had actually teams who, when they win any series, it is actually shocking. Usually in baseball, any team can beat anyone over the course of a small sample. And this was an example of a Rockies team who's not that bad going into Queens against a Mets team that you thought, okay, maybe they got back on track with the series win against Minnesota. Not really. Not really. I mean, this looked even worse. And I know this is what Anthony DiComo wrote after the game, is that in some ways this was even more dispiriting than the 12-game losing streak because it looked even worse. You're still at home. Yes, you still have so much more talent than the Rockies, even if they are improved from last season. And Mendoza's at a loss for words afterwards, say, I've never seen anything like this in terms of this offensive slump.
Yeah, let's
but I'll
just do Mendoza.
What I said last time. I mean, we could talk about Mendoza, but the offense has now sunk to the worst in the sport, and it's not even particularly close. They've scored two runs or fewer in half of their games. They have a 78 OPS plus as a team, 288 on base percentage. And you can point to some of the guys that are now missing, whether it's Lindor or Bichette. Like, I don't care. You have enough other good players that you should not be one of the worst offenses that we've ever seen is what this has been so far. So whoever's fault that is, whether it's Mendoza or not, I don't know. But this is trending so fast in a historically bad direction that is why you ask questions about the manager, because that's just what happens. The manager gets fired, whether it's his fault or not.
I have remained adamant that Mendoza is not getting fired. Now, that opinion was based on a belief that the Mets would have enough time to turn this around. Not even enough time, but that they would eventually get things back on track enough that Mendoza would keep his job. That Steve Cohen, David Stearns were not going to overreact to a bad stretch and get rid of a manager they really like and they think is capable and they think is the right guy. That belief is wavering now for me because they just got swept by the Rockies. And there does come a point where you lose enough games where there has to be something different. Now, I think it is more likely that you maybe shake up some of the hitting coaches. Now, that's tough because these guys are all in their first year, a lot of them. And so if you're going to make a big move, it's like, who are you making the move for and what and why? And that's what makes a lot of this weird. I think Carlos Mendoza is really good at this. And I think that the Mets think Carlos Mendoza is really good at this. And let me just say, the New York Mets are not hiring Alex Cora. Like, that is just not David Stearns' MO. Okay. If they get rid of Carlos Mendoza, maybe they do, maybe they don't. If they do, they're not bringing in Alex Cora. That is not the answer to their problems. Maybe it is the answer to their problems. There's no way David Stearns thinks that's the answer to their problems. I just want to be very clear about that.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. So then let's move past Mendoza and just think about this, because what I just said before is, okay, well, when your team sucks, someone usually has to get fired and it ends up being the manager. That's kind of the circle of life here in this sport, not just baseball. I know this happens in other sports too. I want to reference kind of an interesting thread from our friend Chelsea Janes, who pointed out, it's like, okay, yes, they have to change something. You just mentioned, well, it'd be hard to do that with the coaching staff because a lot of them just got there. You could make a trade. And it's weird. These are not conversations we ever have right now. And by the way, you could also apply this to the Red Sox to a degree. That's a little bit different because of they have purposefully did not make a trade to keep all their outfielders, and it's clearly not working. With the Mets, they have guys missing. And so if you are trying to save this season and you do not want to change the coaching staff, there are ways to go improve your team. They are very rare at this time of year and will likely cost you real prospects. That does not seem like something David Stearns would want to do. However, if you're going to keep falling into this deep hole, you could sign Austin Slater, or you could call up Ryan Clifford or whatever, Nick Morabito. That's an option. You can shake up your lineup as much times. Or there's no rule that says you can't call some other bad team and say, hey, we'll give you a top 10 prospect if you give us one of your best hitters. That's allowed. It would be very unusual, but that is allowed. But that gets back to what you just said.
Allowed.
I don't. David Stearns here is a very interesting one because Craig Breslow has been, and he's not that he hasn't made some good moves. His tenure has undoubtedly come under fire in ways that is not a secret. Whereas Stearns' reputation is still kind of floating in this interesting spot, but is very much at risk to a degree right now. And so that is where I'm so interested as to where this goes. If we accept, and I do think I mostly agree with you, that he wants to stick with Mendoza and not turn this into this kind of chaotic shuffling, then it becomes about, all right, who's on this team? And yes, injuries are a part of this conversation, but who's on this team? Why are they on this team? Why isn't Bobichet hitting? Why? Oh, Jorge Polanco's hurt. Surprise, surprise. Okay, Lindor, that's bad luck. Soto, that's bad luck. You still have a lot of other players that you chose to bring in here, young players that you believed in, right? The benches and so on and so on. So this is where I think the David Stearns conversation is going to be very interesting as this season goes on. They are 9-19, which is the worst record in baseball, tied with the Philadelphia Phillies, but they did get swept, so we will talk more about them later. Three more sweeps from the weekend. We head to St. Louis, where the Mariners of Seattle are starting to figure some stuff out. Slowly but surely, this was also an offense that looked pretty ugly early on in the season. Cal Raleigh is certainly starting to heat up. He is now up to, I think, seven home runs. He is looking much better. They get a good start from Kirby on Friday. Saturday was one of the wackiest games of the season. There were 8 total home runs in that one. Mariners win that one 11-9. Cal hits a 6th homer on Sunday, and they survive late. Jose Ferrer gets his first Mariners save with Munoz down, having thrown the previous 2 nights. And this is big for Seattle because they were 1-8 on the road before this weekend. So for them to go to St. Louis and sweep that one, and they go to Minnesota this weekend, or this week, I should say, to continue a road trip against a team that is also struggling, who we are about to talk about, the Minnesota Twins. The Mariners are still not back to 500, but they are starting to look more like themselves. And in the American League West, which currently is led by the 15-13 Yolo County A's, I think that keeps the Mariners in a pretty decent spot. As for the Cardinals, they're kind of like the Nationals to some degree. They're going to hit a lot of homers and score some runs, and you're going to enjoy watching their young position players. And then you're going to realize, oh, they don't have that. They don't have a lot of good pitching, and they're going to lose. Like, that's kind of what's going to happen with the Cardinals this season, which is kind of the plan, and that's fine. That's okay. That's totally fine for them.
The Tampa Bay Rays are a little bit pesky. They took all 3 games over the Minnesota Twins over the weekend to move to 16-11. Taj Bradley for the Twins bad in a potential revenge start on Friday. Shane McClanahan 5 scoreless on Sunday. Griffin Jacks goes 2 1/3 innings scoreless as an opener in game 3. Very odd. Yandy Diaz, home run, Rays win 4-2. The Twins lost 9 of 10 after starting 11-17. Their only win was when Devin Williams peed his pants in the first game of that Mets series. The Rays, like, look, they will never stink. It is impossible for them to stink. How good are they? TBD. They're certainly fun. This team makes a lot of contact. They use their wheels. They're good at defense. They're an entertaining watch. They're coming to Cleveland this week, so you'll get eyeballs on them.
I sure will. One more sweep from the weekend, and it was a late-breaking sweep indeed. The Royals said we will be spoken about earlier on. It's possible. If the Royals did not come back from 6-0, we would probably spend 10 seconds on this series. Instead, we will give the Kansas City Royals some credit, who swept the Angels. They got a solid Noah Cameron start on Friday. Cole Reagans was incredible on Saturday.
Finally.
Racked up 27 whiffs. Yeah, that was really good to see because he's been kind of shaky until now. And Royals Cruz on Saturday and then Sunday night. Well, I guess it was Sunday afternoon and then it became Sunday night because there was a rain delay anyway. This was Sunday night baseball. It was moved up 3 hours to avoid the rain. They still ended up with a 1.5-hour rain delay. The Angels were up 6-0. They pounced on Seth Lugo, who stayed in the game and still managed to pitch 6 innings and allow 14 hits, but allowed the Royals to kind of save their bullpen relatively. Jack Caglione down to their last out with a massive game-tying homer off Drew Pomeranz, and then Lane Thomas, a walk-off homer off Joey Lucchese, who was pitching for some reason in the bottom of the 10th. This was a Kurt Suzuki disaster class all across the board, but ultimately the Royals took advantage. Their players showed up. Bobby Witt Jr. hit his first home run of the season. Congratulations to him. That leaves Fernando Tatis Jr. atop the Why Haven't You Homered Yet leaderboard. I'm sure he asked for it. And good for the Royals, who are now 9-7 at home, 2-10 on the road. So still a lot to prove as they sit down there at 11-17. But Angels, not good at baseball. Royals looking pretty good, I say, in their fancy
City Connects. Yeah. Royals City Connect uniforms have, my opinion on them has fallen more after seeing them in person on uniform, like on TV, than any other uniform I've ever seen. Like,
oh, gone down.
I thought these looked cool. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I hate them. I thought these looked cool on paper, and then I saw them on body on TV. Oh, the hats, terrible. I'm so out. Never been more out. Sorry.
All right. Well, they worked for them. Worked for them this weekend. So you might have to keep watching.
You know what I would say, Jordan, about those uniforms? I don't think it's productive to get into the merits of an individual decision. Let's take a break, and when we get back, we'll talk about all the other baseball teams. Here we go. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Let's start by going around the league. Three premier series from the weekend. Dodgers over the Cubs, Braves over the Phillies, Yankees over the Astros. None of these being Sunday Night Baseball is weird and eyebrow-raising, and I would like to know why. Cubs roll into Dodger Stadium on a W-9, win on Friday night in what was just like a crisp, well-played, dramatic ball game full of very fun moments, worth the 10-minute highlight package on YouTube. Cubs take that one 6-4. Roki gets his first W of the year, going really mediocre outing. 5 innings, 4 runs, just 1 walk. Just 1 walk, 3 solo home runs allowed. The Cubs, their pitching was also bad. Colin Ray with a stinker. Dodgers win 12-4. Roki throwing a slightly different and better splitter with more velocity on it. Got 15 whiffs total on the day. Struck out 5. This was the best that he has looked. And yet it was still like actually statistically not very good. Dodgers take the kicker on Sunday, winning 6-0. Otani goes 3-for-3 with a homer. Justin Wroblewski is like kind of awesome.
Yeah, and you wonder, okay, why do they keep sticking with Roki? Well, on one hand, you could say, well, they have better options. On the other hand, you could say, well, if they're running this six-man rotation effectively, and Wroblewski and Emmett Sheehan, who before the bullpen blew it on Friday, was incredible, they have the best, even with Roki doing what Roki's doing, whatever that is, it's been the most effective rotation in baseball, pretty much. So
Justin Wroblewski has been the second best pitcher on the Los Angeles Dodgers behind Shohei Ohtani.
Yeah. Yeah. Wroblewski's been outstanding. Ohtani's first 3-hit game of the season. I know we were starting to, you know, with him, it's like he has like 4 or 5 bad games in a row. And it's like, what's wrong? What's wrong? Did he forget how to hit? It's like, no, he's going to be okay. He's still Shohei Ohtani. So good response from the Dodgers there. The Cubs did get their 10th win in a row there. But if they were going to really make a statement and be like, we are one of the best teams in baseball, we are going to jump the Dodgers in Jordan's power rankings, that did not happen after what happened on Saturday and Sunday. But still, Cubs, I think they're pretty solid.
Ohtani Cy Young watch. It's a quick update here. Ohtani currently has a 3.8, not a 3.80, a 0.38 ERA in 24 innings across 4 starts. Now, that is, as we talked about, fewer starts, fewer innings than most of the other pitchers that will be in the mix for a Cy Young. Cam Schlittler, who he won't be competing against, I realize. Tyler Glasnow even is up to 33 innings. You have Nolan McClain at 35, Max Fried and AL up to 41. Like, he's going to be short on innings. However, he is not allowed a home run. Shohei Ohtani has not allowed a home run. He has been as stellar on the bump as we ever could have imagined.
And I was about to mention that. We don't do this as often on the show, but why haven't you allowed a home run yet is also something that I like to track. And Shohei Ohtani has faced 92 batters without allowing a home run. Justin Wroblewski has faced 119, which is second on the current leaderboard behind only Pirates right-hander Carmen Majinski. Carmen Majinski, shout out to you. Anyway, so yes, Ohtani, good at pitching, good at hitting. He's amazing. Okay, let's go to the Braves and the Phillies. Remember, the Phillies, just as after getting mopped by the Cubs, they showed up to Atlanta on this brutal losing streak, a losing streak that continued on Friday as the Braves score 3 in the 6th to take a late lead and win 5-3. That was an L10 for Philadelphia. But on Saturday, finally, some good news for the Phillies as Zach Wheeler comes back, looks pretty good. They survive another quality Bryce Elder outing. Hello, hello. And they get it done in extra innings. Bryce Harper drives in 4 runs. Phillies win 8-5, and they snap their losing streak. But it was right back to reality on Sunday as Chris Sale comes out and dominates, allows 1 hit over 6 scoreless innings. Aaron Nola is very bad. Kyle Schwarber homers late, but it doesn't matter as the Braves win 6-2 and are the first team to 20 wins, which is a lot more than the Phillies, who are still looking for their 10th win. So, yeah, this isn't going awesome for the Phillies of Philadelphia.
Should I go up there this week? Do I need to go? I did Mets sad. I did Red Sox sad. Like, should I go check in on?
I mean, it's going pretty bad
Astros
right now.
Astros in Baltimore, Astros in Baltimore. I can go look at them, and they are the next relevant character as they lose 2 out of 3 against the New York Yankees. Game 1. Yankees score 3 in the top first, and then that's really it. They win 12-4. Ben Rice hits his 9th. Game 2, Ryan Weathers, Mike Burrows were both pretty good, but the Yankees pounce all over Houston's pen with homers from Grisham, Caballero, and Austin Wells. Yordan hits 3 balls, 110, and goes 1-for-4. Baseball is a weird sport. Game 3, Spencer Arrighetti, Mr. Spaghetti, dominant, 1 earned over 7. Judge goes yard for his 10th, though. Astros offense shows up and they win 7-4 off of Luis Gil, the 2024 AL Rookie of the Year. He's back to AAA. He is now a Scranton Rail Rider. And on the way up in his place will be Jason 2S Dominguez, who has been very good in AAA for Scranton.
But a little weird because Jason Dominguez is not going to be the 5 starter. So I am curious where Dominguez's playing time starts to come in. The more important thing, Luis Gil, who's just been really bad pretty much since he won Rookie of the Year.
Yeah.
He's been bad almost the whole time. They have these other starters that are working their way back with Gerrit Cole and Carlos Rodon. And so I don't know what Luis Gil's... I mean, there should be a role for him in the bullpen. He should be able to be good. As for Dominguez, he's been great in AAA. Surprise, surprise. He's still 23 years old. How do they work him in? Let's find out. I would like to see him get some at-bats. Not that the Yankees are starving for offense. That is also why this is interesting. It is not like, oh, God, it's Alex Verdugo's out there. It's no, they're scoring runs.
They're playing well.
I'm curious. They are playing well. But maybe this is like Stanton is sneaky injured. That wouldn't shock me. We'll see how this kind of shakes out.
Jazz Chisholm Jr., stop challenging, brother. He is, 1-for-7 now? And he's doing it in the worst situations. Like, he's so bad at this, dude.
Yeah. I've exhibited skepticism regarding the notion that individual players would be prevented from challenging, but it really does feel like he's trending in that direction
might have had the worst challenge of the season this over the weekend.
It was
in game 1.
It was very bad. It was bases empty, second inning, 2-1 pitch. It was right down the middle. All of those things are very bad. However, they have been telling him the whole time, hey, dude, stop challenging. And you can't stop him. It's the player's prerogative. So I don't know what's going to happen. Maybe he's going to start getting fined. I don't know how they're going to stop him, which is very funny. We love ABS. All right, we have 7 more series. Let's go fast, folks.
Faster than fast, quicker than quick. I am lightning.
I feel the need for speed.
It's turbo time.
Pirates, 2 out of 3 over the Brewers. They had a chance for a sweep, couldn't get the job done. On Sunday, Paul Skeens perfect for 6 2/3 innings on Sunday. Rake Bowers breaks it up with a single. Skeens ERA down to 2.48 after that opening day stinker. It already looks good. It did not take that much time. I did not think he was going to have an ERA in double digits for long. And here we are. Pirates win that one 6-0. Connor Griffin, first career home run on his 20th birthday, getting the silent treatment in the dugout. Game 2, Mizorowski and Mitch Keller, both solid. Pirates bullpen outlast Brewers bullpen, and they win 6-3 in 10 innings. Brewers are a weird team right now. They do get the win on Sunday behind 6 scoreless 12 Ks from Kyle Harrison and a 5-0 victory.
The Blue Jays take 2 out of 3 over the Cleveland Guardians. Max Scherzer looked very bad in the opener. He allows a couple home runs to Angel Martinez, who has looked very good. However, Toronto bounces back over the next couple days, getting some big saves from Louis Varland, who has now assumed the closer role, essentially, with Jeff Hoffman figuring his stuff out earlier on in the game. They got a big home run from... Yeah, he did pitch the 8th on Sunday, but he's not the closer right now because he was struggling so badly. Okamoto may be starting to figure it out. There's some underlying stuff with him that has looked good. The hard hit rates have been there. He's been walking. He's just been striking out so much more than a lot of people expected, but starting to put it together. And then Jesus Sanchez has the big go-ahead home run on Sunday. He has been sneaky, really important for this lineup, considering how injured it is. And it is funny that he's pretty much, not that the Astros like need the offense, but he's pretty much doing exactly what I think the Astros were hoping he would do for them last year. And just, he was horrible, but he's filling a very clear role for Toronto and he's been a really nice fit there. So a nice series win there for Toronto as Cleveland now returns home to face those red hot Tampa Bay Rays. I'll see them this week.
The Cincinnati Reds are better than you think, or are they? They are 18 and 10 and have a +1 run differential. That is incredible. They are 7-0 now in one-run games. They win by one run on Friday night in a really wonky one that includes 2 home runs from Matt McClain, 2 home runs from Nathaniel Lowe, including a 2-run walk-off winner to win 9-8. They win on Saturday because Jack Flaherty has a bad start for the Tigers. They win that 9-2, a real blowout in their book. Can't finish the sweep, as the Reds bullpen allows a 3-run home run to How You Lee. How you doing? First career home run. 5th straight game with a homer for Torque. And the Tigers win 8-3. The Detroit Tigers are... It's the beginning of the season is so interesting, right? Because it's like, if you don't get in my line of sight until May 1st, that means that you're doing fine. April is about treading water and just giving yourself a chance for the rest of the season. The Tigers are 15-14. Like, the Rangers are 14-14. The Orioles are 13-15. You're there. You're in the mix, right? No one's asking for your manager to get fired. That's good enough at this point of the season. Speaking about good enough at this point of the season, the San Francisco Giants crawl their way closer to .500 as they take 2 out of 3. Over the Miami Marlins at home, winning games 2 and 3. Game 2 behind a solid Robbie Ray start. Robbie Ray, every time I see him do anything, I'm like, how are you not Australian? Game 3, Landon Rupp, 7 2/3, 3 earned, big homer from Casey Schmidt, who was an .891 OPS. Wonder if that'll sustain. Probably not. But the Giants getting back in the swing of things, and they are they're in the mix adjacent. They're in the mix adjacent. They head to Philly this week, which will be interesting.
Oh, okay. I was gonna say Detroit is heading to Atlanta. The Giants, it's like, that was another team we were really focused on early on. They got a lot of work to do, but good to see them winning a home series against the Marlins. The Washington Nationals take 2 out of 3 over the Chicago White Sox. Murakami hits his 11th home run of the season in the opener as the White Sox win that one. But the Nationals bounce back with a couple of extra innings victories, 6-3 on Saturday, 2-1 on Sunday. The Nationals getting some good pitching. Jake Irvin was fantastic on Saturday, and Foster Griffin continues to be very, very, very effective. So credit to the Nats for getting a couple like normal close victories against a White Sox team that, while way more watchable, is still pretty bad. But hey, Murakami, he's fun. Two more series. This was a weird one. The D-backs and Padres split two games in Mexico City. Ildemaro Vargas has been unbelievable. I need to interrogate this a little bit further, but I'm enjoying it because he seems like a delightful human and he's having the time of his life. His OPS is 1105 somehow, and he's a 20-game hitting streak to start the season. Mason Miller sets a new franchise record for scoreless innings, consecutive scoreless innings at 34 2/3. Sorry to Clay Meredith, a record that apparently was well regarded. I didn't know that they got like Clay Meredith to record a video.
Is not Claw? It's spelled
sure,
Claw.
Sure looks like Claw. Sure looks like Claw. But no, that is.
But it ain't Claw.
This was the. By the way, so Mason Miller does not pitch on Sunday because the Padres just completely imploded in the innings before he could pitch. D-backs come back and split this one. Final series. The A's, the first place A's, go into Texas and take 2 out of 3 over the Rangers. Luis Severino was terrific on Friday. Rangers bounced back with a big go-ahead homer from Josh Young to win 4-3 on Saturday. But then the A's relievers, 5 relievers after JT Ginn, keep the Rangers' bats quiet. Kumar Rocker, a good start, goes wasted as the A's win the series and that game 2-1. Nick Kurtz has walked in 16 consecutive games. That is approaching Barry Bonds' modern era record, essentially, which was 18 in a row in 2002. So Nick Kurtz, that dude is ridiculously good. And I'm not surprised that he is a part of a fun fact like this. And the A's, credit to them for really pitching it, although pretty much anyone can pitch it when they go to Globe Life Field. Which is a good transition to our final topic today, which is that I'm working on our power rankings for this week. And I'm looking at these teams who have all the good players and are playing like garbage, like the Phillies and the Mets and the Red Sox. Although the Red Sox, like, they're bad, but I'm not putting them at the bottom. I'm just asking you, Jake, I know this is my work, but how far can we reasonably drop these teams? Should I have the Mets below the Rockies? I guess I have to. It feels a little ridiculous. I feel like I will have the White Sox at 30. I feel good about that. I think the Twins, who have we mentioned earlier, have been really bad, and the Angels will be down in that
right.
mix.
Who can be below the Phillies and the Mets, right? Who can be below them? I think
and who can be can above them?
The White Sox, the Royals, the Angels, the Twins, below them.
The Royals. Okay, so the Royals, I mean, the Royals just swept the Angels, so they're obviously going to be ahead of the Angels.
I understand, so, but they're only 2 games better than the Mets and the Phillies. It's not right. as yep. like, you know, it's just 2 games. The Twins, I could put below them.
Yeah.
And I have to say that's it.
Yeah, I think that's where I'm leaning.
I think the Rockies, I think, you know what you could do? You could do Phillies, Rockies, Mets.
Yeah.
Basically be like the Rockies beat the Mets, so they're above them, but the Phillies are still above the Rockies.
Yeah, like 24, 5, 6. Yeah. 6.
But so the Marlins and the Nats, you got to put above them, man.
Tough one.
Like, you got to put above them.
For sure. Yeah, the Nats have earned it. I am struggling with the Red Sox also. Their record is still
down
there.
What about at the very top?
Still...
Braves or Dodgers?
So at the very top. So at the very top, then the main question is, does Atlanta deserve the number one spot over the Dodgers? I am leaning towards no and keeping the top three the same that I had 2 weeks ago, which was Dodgers, Braves, Yankees. And then we'll figure it out after then. But do you think the Braves have done enough to jump the Dodgers?
I mean, they only have one more win. Like, they have the same number of losses. They have one more win. If they had swept, if the Braves had swept, yes. But I think it at this point, it is reasonable to keep them behind the Dodgers.
Yes, that is where I'm leaning. And then as for sorting out the NL Central,
do it later.
Well, that's
future Jordan's problem. That will be my day. You know what doesn't need power rankings discourse? Yep. You know what doesn't need power rankings discourse, Jordan? The Buffalo Sabres, brother. Oh, Boston, you had a bad weekend because your baseball manager got fired? Oopsies. Sabres going in to the Garden in Boston, taking 2 games from the Bruins. The Burrs are up 3-1 in the wild card round of the NHL Pucktober of Hocktober. And the vibes are good here in Saberland.
Yeah, is it the wild card round? Whatever. The point is they play game 5 on Tuesday. Hopefully the Sabres will have advanced the next time we talk to you on Wednesday. Meanwhile, wow, the Lightning and Canadians are enjoying quite the series of themselves. Sabres hopefully will win on Tuesday and then can sit back and relax as the Lightning and Canadians go to 7 games. Sabres are chilling, but then we'd be waiting for so long. I don't know how it's going to be tough to go. This is going to be like the Olympic break where it's like, oh, when are the Sabres on again? This sucks. We got to wait forever. Anyway, Peyton Krebs, you are an absolute beast. That's it for this Monday edition of Baseball Barbacast. Thank you to Andrew Hart's TJ Bressel for producing. You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com, and we'll be back on Wednesday. Bye.